We're going to be looking at Isaiah 13 to begin with tonight, so you can turn there. So Isaiah 13 starts a whole different section of Isaiah. We've been looking at there's various things about Israel and Judah and the Lord's relationship to them, but suddenly, starting in Isaiah 13, we have a whole series of prophecies about other nations. So if you look at Isaiah 13:1, that's Babylon, and then he's got Assyria starting in 1424 and Philistia starting in 1428. Then you can look at 15:1, there's Moab. 17:1, there's Damascus. 18:1, there's Cush. 19:1 is Egypt, and so forth and so on. So it just goes through a series of prophecies regarding other nations. Now, I would say that these are not what we would normally consider the most exciting passages, because we don't relate as well to these other nations, and maybe it doesn't seem as relevant. Why do we need to know what God says to these nations? Well, I think there's several good reasons. One is that God is the Lord of all the nations. He is the sovereign God of the universe, and he controls what's going to happen with each and every country that exists. God is absolutely in charge, and it's helpful for us to see that. Secondly, one of the difficulties that the Israelites had so much was this tendency to put their trust and confidence in other nations and alliances with other nations. And this really shows the folly of putting our trust in anyone but the Lord. He's in charge of the nations. And the nations that they were most tempted to rely on and they saw as the strongest and most enduring, God would bring down any time he chose. Babylon especially was almost the epitome of worldly glory. It was an ancient nation, Babylon, where it got its name, right? That was from the Tower of Babel. So it goes all the way back to that. And Babylon was just a proud, strong, very long-lasting city and nation. It was kind of a summarized man's effort to create security and stability on his own. And what we're going to see is, Babylon was not anything before the Lord. So look at chapter 13, verse 1. The oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz saw, lift up a standard on the bare hill, raise your voice to them, wave the hand that they may enter the doors of the nobles. I have commanded my consecrated ones. I have even called my mighty warriors, my proudly exalting ones, to execute my anger. So the Lord calls his army. How does he do it? Well, he raises up a flag on a bare hill. And understand that being a bare hill, it would be not concealed by the trees, so it would be more visible. And he waves his hand, and he lifts up his voice. Now, those do not seem like really radical, exhausting efforts on God's part. Put a flag on the hill, raise his voice, and wave his hand. That's all it takes for God's army to come. As soon as God calls them, look at verse 4. A sound of tumult on the mountains like that of many people, a sound of the uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts is mustering the army for battle. They are coming from a far country, from the farthest horizons, the Lord and his instruments of indignation to destroy the whole land. It is amazing what God can do with a flag, a voice, and a hand gesture. He brings those powerful nations coming against Babylon just like that. They're the instruments God is using to take vengeance against Babylon. Now, it's kind of interesting that Isaiah writes first in this list of nations about Babylon. Because in Isaiah's own day, Babylon was around, but they were mostly dominated by the Assyrians. The Assyrians were the world empire of the day, though Babylon would occasionally flex its muscle and become independent. But they certainly weren't the superpower that they were about to become. But Isaiah, before Babylon becomes great Babylon, already writes that God was going to bring her down. It's amazing. God has the number of the nations that are going to come into power, as well as the ones that are ruling right now. So when God brings the instruments of his indignation, look what happens, verse 6. Wail! For the day of the Lord is near. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will fall limp, and every man's heart will melt. They will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look at one another in astonishment, their faces aflame. Panic would unnerve them. They would just be scared to death. You know, their hands would just fall to their sides, and their heart would melt. Because when the Lord comes against a nation, it is utter terror. He says, verse 9, behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation, and he will exterminate its sinners from it. It doesn't sound like you want to meet the Lord on the rampage, right? For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises, and the moon will not shed its light. You know, if you don't get any light, you don't have any life. It's darkness, it's frightening, it's chaos. God's just going to make all the heavenly bodies darken over Babylon. Their lights are going out. Thus I will punish, verse 11, the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold and mankind than the gold of Ophir. So many people are going to die in battle that they become scarcer than the rare gold of Ophir, which was apparently the highest class gold there was. You read about it several times in the Old Testament. That was apparently the class of gold, and there wasn't a lot of it. And he said, God's just going to wipe out the Babylonians. But did you notice why? This is not just God arbitrarily deciding he's going to, you know, mow down a nation. It's because of their evil, their iniquity, the arrogance of their pride, and the haughtiness of their ruthlessness. There is so much in Isaiah against pride. You remember back in chapter 2:11, the proud look of man will be abased, and the loftiness of man will be humbled, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. And he goes on in chapter 2 to talk about all the high things God was going to bring down. And you remember chapter 9 and verse 8, where God is bringing down Ephraim and Samaria, who assert in verse 9 in pride and in arrogance of heart, well, we've had a setback, but it's really for the best because we'll just build back greater and bigger and stronger. That kind of an attitude, the Lord was not very impressed by that. Remember 10:12, when God will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the pomp of his haughtiness, and now it's Babylon. God hates pride. God brings it down every single time. When somebody thinks he's tough enough, man enough, or empire enough to defy the Lord, whoa, that is a very foolish action. And so God says in verse 13, therefore I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place at the fury of the Lord of hosts in the day of his burning anger. Such instability, everything just shakes, you know, like an earthquake. It will be that like a hunted gazelle, or like sheep with none to gather them, that each will turn to his own people, and each will flee to his own land. Anyone who is found will be thrust through, and anyone who's captured will fall by the sword. Their little ones also will be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses will be plundered, and their wives ravished. That doesn't sound like you want to be a part of Babylon or anywhere close to it when this happens. Now, again, remember that Isaiah's writing this before Babylon became Babylon. Babylon's been around a long time, an ancient culture, but it's Assyria that's dominant right now. Babylon was going to conquer Assyria about 100 years later and become the great world empire that it was. But God knew that Babylon would only last in its heyday for about 70 years, which is really short for world empires. And then the Medes and the Persians were going to bring them down. Look at verse 17. Behold, I'm going to stir up the Medes against them, who will not value silver or take pleasure in gold. You understand why he's saying that, right? Their only motivation is conquest, so you can't even bribe them to get off your back. They don't care about silver or gold. They just want to destroy Babylon. And their bows will mow down the young men. They will not even have compassion on the fruit of the womb, nor will their eyes pity children. And Babylon, the beauty of kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation, nor will the Arab bitches tent there, nor will shepherds make their flocks lie down there, but desert creatures will lie down there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will live there, and shaggy goats will frolic there. Hyenas will howl in their fortified towers, and jackals in their luxurious palaces. Her fateful time also will soon come, and her days will not be prolonged. This once great city was going to ultimately be reduced to nothing. Babylon, the cradle of civilization, would return to chaos. Now, when you read prophecies like this, you understand that this is poetic language. This is a poetic description of Babylon being brought down. But there are a number of times when in poetic descriptions we see remarkable literal fulfillments. I remember, for example, in Zechariah 9, it talked about how the Lord would come with salvation. He'd be humble, mounted on a donkey, the foal of a colt. Or a colt, the foal of a donkey, I think is the way that goes. And you know, I believe God, that Jesus would never have had to ride on anything to fulfill that prophecy. The prophecy is going to be humble, and that's a way of describing it. But God didn't want us not to realize that Jesus was that person and that he was being humble. He actually had him ride into Jerusalem on exactly that. You know, there's a number of times when it's just remarkable how even in poetic passages, God will cause it to be fulfilled to the letter. Now, I said all that to say this. Go back and look. Scan down through 20, 21, and 22. And I want to read some things for you. There is a book called They Wrote on Clay, written by Edward, and I don't know his last name's pronunciation, Chiera. I'd say Chiera, but I don't know if that's what he said. This was published in 1939 after he died, but it was written by him. He was an archaeologist. And this is all in just the preface to his book. It's actually a letter to his wife. He's gone over to Babylon as an archaeologist, and he's just writing down some of his impressions as he's there at the ruins of Babylon. So he says, "This evening I made my usual pilgrimage to the mound covering the ancient temple tower. It is only a few hundred yards from our camp, and it is pleasant to ascend to the summit of that tower which dominates the landscape. This I generally do in the evening after supper in the bright moonlight. Today I have come with the ambition of jotting down my impressions, for the spectacle moves me deeply." And he describes all kinds of stuff as he writes this. And he describes just the feel of being at the ruins of Babylon. He writes, "A dead city. I have visited Pompeii and Ostia, and I have taken walks along the empty corridors of the Palatine, but those cities are not dead. They are only temporarily abandoned. The hum of life is still heard, and life blooms all around. They are but a step in the progress of that civilization to which they have contributed their full share and which marches on under their very eyes. Here only is real death. Not a column or an arch still stands to demonstrate the permanency of human work. Everything has crumbled into dust." He says, "Under my feet are some holes which have been burrowed by foxes and jackals. At night they descend stealthily from their haunts in their difficult search for food and appear silhouetted against the sky. This evening they appear to sense my presence and stay in hiding, perhaps wondering at this stranger who has come to disturb their peace." And he talks about the silence and so forth. He says, a jackal is now sending forth his howl, half cry, half threat. He said, it's now quite dark. Caution would advise descending immediately to avoid the danger of falling into one of the many trenches. But a certain fascination holds me here. I should like to find a reason for all this desolation. This is amazing. There's no indication he knows anything about Isaiah. But listen to this. Why should a flourishing city, the seat of an empire, have completely disappeared? Is it the fulfillment of a prophetic curse that changed a superb temple into a den of jackals? Did the actions of the people who lived here have anything to do with this? Or is it the fatal destiny of mankind that all its civilizations must crumble when they reach their peak? Isn't that amazing? He had no idea. It was the fulfillment of what God said he was going to do. And what he writes here is almost word for word the kind of thing that Isaiah 13 says. Now, like I say, I don't think that this had to be fulfilled with those very animals and all of that. But evidently it was from Edward Kiera's description there. I've used that for a number of years and just find that fascinating. It's just, you know, there's so many things in the scriptures that just keep confirming your faith over and over again. Something like that to me is just astounding. It's like, wow, God did exactly what he said he was going to do. And it brought down a great empire. And when you want to, you know, talk about what Babylon's going to do in the 21st century, not much. You know, it's not around. Now, look at verse 14. Now, chapter 14. When the Lord will have compassion on Jacob and again choose Israel and settle them in their own land, then strangers will join them and attach themselves to the house of Jacob. The peoples will take them along and bring them to their place, and the house of Israel will possess them as an inheritance in the land of the Lord as male servants and female servants. And they will take their captors captive and will rule over their oppressors. Now what you see is that there will be a great deliverance for God's people. Now, in part, when Babel was brought down, that provided deliverance for the Israelites. The Medo-Persians let the Israelites go back to Jerusalem, rebuild the temple, the city, etc. But I really think that this goes beyond that to think about the spiritual deliverance in Christ. But having, you know, mentioned for a moment God's blessing his people again, he goes back to Babylon. In verse 3 he says, and it will be in that day when the Lord gives you rest from your pain and turmoil and harsh service in which you've been enslaved, that you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon and say, how the oppressor has ceased and how fury has ceased. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers which used to strike the peoples in fury with unceasing strokes, which subdued the nations in anger with unrestrained persecution. The whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into shouts of joy. Even the cypress trees rejoice over you and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you were laid low, no tree cutter comes against us. So you see the rest and relief that the earth had when God brought the Babylonians down. You don't have Babylon coming and cutting down all the trees anymore, which probably is not so much a reference to like physical trees. It's just mowing down the people. But now the great ruler that had brought an atmosphere of terror to the nation now will be broken, and there won't be any Babylon that will destroy. So think about what happens to the king of Babylon then. If he's brought down, where does he go? Well, look at verse 9. Sheol, which is the realm of the dead, from beneath is excited over you to meet you when you come. It arouses for you the spirits of the dead, all the leaders of the earth. It raises all the kings of the nations from their throne. It's kind of mock homage. When the king of Babylon, the great Babylonian emperor, went down to Sheol, why, all the great rulers rise up to welcome him into the realm of the dead. They all respond and say to you, even you have been made weak as we. You have become like us. Your pomp and the music of your harps have been brought down to Sheol. Maggots are spread out as your bed beneath you, and worms are your covering. So they see that death has obliterated any greatness of the king of Babylon. They're all the same level now. They're all being eaten by the maggots, and worms are their covering. You know, you can be as great and powerful and whatever you want to be in this life. When you die, all that's gone. Period. When you go into the realm of the dead, you're not going to be a big shot. They don't have big shots down there. And your body will just decompose just like everybody else's body decomposes. And that's what he's seeing. Babylon's brought down and his great emperor is brought down. Then they're all just surprised to see him and give him a big old welcome into the realm of the dead. How you have fallen from heaven, verse 12. O star of the morning, son of the dawn, you've been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations. Now, they're sort of mocking him by calling him the how he's fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. It's what he thought about himself. He thought he was, you know, God's gift to man. But he wasn't. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you. They will ponder over you, saying, is this the man who made the earth tremble? Who shook kingdoms? Who made the world like a wilderness and overthrew its cities? Who did not allow his prisoners to go home? All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb. But you've been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch, clothed with the slain who are pierced with a sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like a trampled corpse. You will not be united with them in burial because you ruined your country. You've slain your people. May the offspring of evildoers not be mentioned forever. Prepare for his sons a place of slaughter because of the iniquity of their fathers. They must not arise and take possession of the earth and fill the face of the world with cities. So there's the end of the king of Babylon. He thought he was so high and mighty. You know, he was going to be like God. He's going to raise his throne way above the heavens, above the stars, above everything. He was going to rule over it all. And hello in Sheol. You know, there he is. And in fact, didn't even get a decent burial. At least the other emperor has got to be buried. He's cast out like a rejected body. You know, just kicked out of the grave, kicked out of the tomb. And so that's the end of the king, the emperor of the Babylonian Empire. Look at verse 22. God says, I will rise up against them, declares the Lord of hosts, and will cut off from Babylon name and survivors, offspring and posterity, declares the Lord. I will also make it a possession for the hedgehog and swamps of water, and I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord of hosts. Don't you love that image? You know, think about a woman who's trying to make sure her house is, you know, presentable and habitable and whatever. So she sweeps out all the trash. You know, you sweep out whatever and you get the dustpan, you sweep it in and put it in the trash and take it out and put it in the dumpster or whatever. Babylon was just rubbish, fit only for the broom of God's judgment. God was going to just sweep out Babylon and there she was going to be gone. The thing that you love about that is here's this Babylon that thinks they're everything. You know, wow, I'm big, I'm powerful, I came out of heaven, and I'm going to exalt myself above heaven, and all Babylon is a bit of trash the Lord sweeps up with his cosmic broom and sends off to the dumpster, to the, you know, town dump or whatever. Then look at verse 24. The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely just as I have intended, so it has happened. And just as I have planned, so it will stand, to break Assyria in my land. And I will trample him on my mountains, that his yoke will be removed from them, and his burden removed from their shoulder. This is the plan devised against the whole earth, And this is the hand that is stretched out against all the nations. For the Lord of hosts has planned, and who can frustrate it? And as for his stretched out hand, who can turn it back? Well, he kind of, you know, goes from the superpower of the future to the superpower of the present, Assyria. But he disposes of Assyria in just four verses. She didn't quite get the attention Babylon did. But the fact is, God's going to break the yoke of Babylon, and it's all going to happen according to the plan and purpose of God. That it always does. God plans things out. What are you going to do about it? He stretches out his hand. Remember how he'd said earlier his hand was still stretched out? That was against Israel. Now it's against Assyria. But when God stretches out his hand, when God makes his plan, he makes his purpose, he decides upon what he's going to do, that's it. So the God that brought down will bring down Babylon a couple or three centuries in the future, a couple of centuries, I guess, will bring down Assyria in the next few decades. Because God is the God who rules over all the nations. Now, the rest of these prophecies against the nations in the book of Isaiah are really talking about mostly nations that were less powerful and less impressive than Babylon and Assyria. But the same pattern will stand. There'll be a lot of really interesting things he says and a lot of good things to learn. But basically, God's in charge of every nation, and he decides whether they stand or fall and how long they last. And it's all based upon their actions and their behavior, and they're submitting to the Lord, or they're proudly defying God. And the same God that ruled over Babylon and Assyria and brought them down rules over every nation today, and he rules over us. And we can't change maybe what the nations do in their response, but we can sure change how we serve him. And we can humble ourselves, and we can trust in him, and we can realize that he is the God in charge. There's no doubt. Even when things don't look so good, and when we become disturbed about, well, what's going to happen with this or with that or with the other thing, God is the great God, the God of gods, the Lord of lords, the God who reigns over all, and we can trust in him. So I appreciate your listening to that tonight. The next time we do Isaiah, we'll pick up the last little section in chapter 14, which is a prophecy really related to the Philistines and the people of God. And go on from there. So I appreciate that. And if you need to submit to the Lord, think about how powerful he is. If he's powerful enough to bring down Babylon or Assyria, we're sure no match for him. We just need to submit to him. We need to be with him, not against him. You're with the Lord? It's great. You're against the Lord? It's terrible. If you need to come and obey him, won't you do that while we stand and sing?